Neo-tangology. From my first steps as a student of tango to becoming a teacher. Written and presented by Graham Guy. Episode 5, Chapter 2, Part 3. The Tango Revival. In about 1980, something remarkable happened in the world of tango, although it is very likely that no one realised its significance until much later. Hector Orazzoli and Claudio Segovia, two set designers from Argentina, decided to put together a stage show about the history of tango. The show, which was to be called Tango Argentino, was to present a history of tango from its earliest days through to its re-emergence in the 1970s. They had hoped that since tango had been such an important part of the city's history over the previous 100 years, that the people of Buenos Aires would lend their support to the project. But unfortunately this was not to be, and they struggled to raise much interest in their idea. Many of the people that had been the biggest names in tango until the 1950s had drifted away from the dance, some due to being unable to make a living from it anymore, some simply due to disillusionment, and tango was starting to look less and less relevant. Orazzoli and Segovia may have been unable to secure any investment for the show in Buenos Aires, and even found it hard to secure a rehearsal space, but they were determined, and even when it looked as though the show may never go ahead, they kept on with its development. One of the main ideas that they'd had was to recreate some of the performances from the early years of tango, and use those to show how the dance had evolved. But this proved to be harder than expected, as they were surprised to find that despite cine cameras being readily available in the area, and many other things being filmed at that time, there was extremely little surviving footage of tango performances available to watch. Instead, Orazzoli and Segovia had to use still photographs taken at shows and milongas and piece them together one after the other to get an idea of how the performances had been presented. For the show, they recruited dancers of all ages and body types to perform, as that would most closely represent the dance scene they were trying to portray. The dancers were invited to choreograph their own routines, and many of them ended up improvising them on the night. Most of them were, or had been, well-known tangueros and tangueras of their time, but some relatively unknown dancers were included as well. Although the show's creators were both well-known set designers, the set itself was kept simple. They used one layout for the stage for the whole production, and the changes of mood were achieved with lighting and through the performances themselves. This kept costs down, but also ensured the focus of the audience would always be on the dancers and the dance. The tango was to be the star of the show, and the simple staging presented it to the audience without distractions. When they had originally come up with the concept for the show a few years earlier, they had hoped to use the orchestra of Anibal Troilo to provide the music. But unfortunately, Troilo had died in 1975, and so they recruited Horacio Salgan and the band Sexteto Mayor instead. This band consisted of one piano, one double bass, two violins and two bandoneons, and was a similar format to the Orchestra Típica of the early tango years, but with slightly fewer musicians. Despite years of effort in putting the show together, and with all the people involved in developing the routines, Orazzoli and Segovia could still not find anywhere willing to host Tango Argentino. But then, in 1983, they were invited to put on a performance at the Festival d'Automne being held at the Centre Pompidou in Paris. So they boarded the only aeroplane they could afford, a military transport plane, and flew to France. The show was an unexpected success. When people saw it, they were captivated, and from its first performance, it received standing ovation after standing ovation. Audiences went home talking about tango and demanding to know where they could see more of this dance, or maybe even try it themselves. Almost overnight, it ignited a huge new demand for tango everywhere the show was performed. And suddenly, the Argentine tango community was back in the spotlight. Success bred success, and Tango Argentino began to tour the world. 1983, in France. 1984, Italy. 1985, New York. And 1985-1986, it went from US to Canada. 87, Japan. 88, Europe. In 1991, it came to the United Kingdom. In 92, it went to Buenos Aires, and then from 99 to 2000, it had a revival on Broadway in New York. Wherever the show was performed, tango fever struck. Audiences were captivated by the diversity of dance styles and the varied interpretations of the music by the dancers. The mix of young and athletic dancers with older and more normal body types resonated with those who watched the show, and everyone who watched it wanted to find out more about this incredible dance. They all saw someone in the show who looked like them, and so instead of simply seeing it as an incredible virtuoso showcase, they also thought, I could do that. This new international interest in tango fueled the rebirth of the dance in Buenos Aires itself, and the old maestros who had been dancing in the Golden Age began to come out of retirement. People started travelling to the city from all over the world to go and study with the maestros, and they in turn soon began travelling Europe, America, and beyond to spread their knowledge and experience of tango far and wide. They would dance demonstrations, teach workshops, train other teachers, and within a very short time the tango phenomenon had spread around the globe. Although no one could have predicted it before the event, the show left a powerful legacy. Tango had been fading for years, falling into irrelevance and becoming little more than a historical footnote, even in its own hometown. But Tango Argentino not only created a huge amount of interest in the dance in the cities where it was performed, it also revitalized the tango community in Buenos Aires and created a new tango tourism industry from nothing. In every city where the show appeared, there soon rose a demand for tango social events, milongas, to be run. People not only wanted to see tango being performed, they also wanted to be a part of it, to dance it themselves and to recreate what they had seen on stage. And so the first milongas that started to appear modeled themselves on what had been seen in the show. The music that was played came directly from the dance halls of 1940s Argentina, with the scratchy recordings evoking a time when tango was at its peak. This was music from the Golden Age, as it came to be known, the period from 1933 to the early 1950s, when the great tango orchestras Típica were performing in bars and clubs around Buenos Aires and Montevideo. In London, the first milonga to emerge from the new wave of tango popularity was a Friday night event called Tango the Argentine Way, held in the London Welsh Centre on Gray's Inn Road. This was started in the early 1990s by Andrew Potter, an Argentine-British dancer who had followed the tour of Tango Argentino and a subsequent show called Forever Tango, and knew that such an event would be popular. His event not only ran as a weekly milonga, but also brought in dancers and maestros from Buenos Aires to teach and inspire the attendees. From there the word spread, and within a very short period of time there were tango clubs, classes, workshops and performances appearing all over London and beyond. Tango had arrived in London in a big way, and the manner of its arrival was to have a dramatic impact on how tango would be taught and interpreted over the years to come. The purpose of the show, Tango Argentino, was to be a historical retrospective of how tango had emerged and evolved from the late 1800s to about 1970. It included references to how people danced and the music being played, but it also presented a view of Argentine society that was specific to that time period. During the early years of tango, the great European immigration wave was in full flow, and as a result, there were far more men around than women. Strict social rules came into being to ensure proper behaviour at the milongas, and these rules then began to be incorporated into tango itself. I will talk about those rules, the códigos, in a later chapter, but for now it is enough to say that the códigos are extensive, all-encompassing, and breaking them can see you ejected from the milonga faster than you can say ocho cortado. When the first milongas appeared, such as Tango the Argentine Way, the códigos were implemented there as well. It helped promote the idea that tango was a little different to other dances. It suggested that it harkened back to a more romantic time, and much like a modern tea dance with big band music from Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey, it was also a period reenactment of what it must have been like to have been there when it all began. The subsequent proliferation of milongas over the next few years followed the same pattern. And although they may not have all gone for the full reenactment experience, most of them implemented some or all of the tango códigos at their events. Today, the códigos are often taught as part of regular classes, and so their inclusion continues. There is no doubt that tango in the UK and in many other countries around the world owes its existence to the wave of popularity that resulted from the show Tango Argentino. Without those performances, it is likely that the only tango we would know about now are the ballroom variants of the dance with their strict regulation and choreographed routines. We would never have come to see the fluid, interpretive, improvisational style that is the hallmark of the tango we now know and love, and the world would have been poorer without it. Tango's return by way of a retrospective show meant that it came with links to a set of rules that had been designed to meet the needs of a different place and a different time. This set tango apart from many other dance styles and lent it an air of exoticism and something romantic that even the ballroom dances with their big band music and stylized outfits could never quite match. It paved the way for tango to flourish and open doors that otherwise may have stayed closed. But it also created the opportunity for a unique tension in the tango world that does not appear in most other dance styles. For some, tango was a chance to experience and absorb the atmosphere of those early golden age clubs and milongas. The music and the dance were inextricably linked, and one could not be experienced without the other. The rules, the culture, and everything that went with tango must be preserved, for to change anything was to disrespect the significance of tango to the culture and history of Buenos Aires. For others, however, the rebirth of tango was an opportunity to allow it to continue its evolution as though it had never stopped. New musical styles and new dance techniques could be used, and tango now had the chance to be brought up to date as we approached and moved into the next century. So this is now the part of the podcast where I go back over some of the things I've said in the first half, and I sort of add my thoughts. These are things which don't really fit into the podcast directly, but I probably needed to be said or needed to be added in just to make sense of a few things. I'm going to start with the improbability, the utter implausibility of a show in Paris about tango rekindling interest in tango everywhere around the world, including in its hometown back in Buenos Aires. I mean, there is absolutely no way that anyone could have predicted that that was going to happen. Orizzoli and Segovia, there's no way that they would have known. It was just a project to take the idea of tango and show its history. I would imagine that they thought there would be a bit of interest from people who've been dancing tango for a while. Or maybe when they went to France, they thought, well, you know, the ballroom dancers, they'll probably be interested in this. But they would not have expected this upsurge of interest that came from it. As far as I know, nothing like this has happened before or since in any sort of dance form. I mean, you know, it would be like running an exhibition of the works of Leonardo da Vinci. And suddenly, everyone around the planet getting really, really interested in this whole idea of painting in the Renaissance art style, it just wouldn't have happened. And so this sudden turnaround from tango being largely irrelevant, even in Buenos Aires, and again, that really needs to be stressed, I think, that people weren't dancing tango in Buenos Aires particularly then. There were a few milongas, there were a few people dancing in their homes, and it hadn't gone away, but it certainly wasn't anything like as popular as it had been prior to the shutdown. As I said in the last podcast, it wasn't just about tango being stopped by the political situation, but it was that everything else had taken over from it. I mean, it was competing with rock and roll, it was competing with television, it was competing with other new music styles by the 70s. It wasn't just rock and roll anymore, it was everything else. And so people had more things to do with their time. And so expecting this show to suddenly turn everything around and produce such a huge interest in the dance, no one could have predicted that. Anyway, yes, so they ran this show, and suddenly everyone wanted to dance tango. They didn't just want to watch it, they wanted to actually get out there and do it. And I think that was a little moment of genius, whether they realised it or not, including dancers who looked like normal people and didn't all look like athletes or gymnasts or, you know, fitness models or whatever. They looked like normal people. So the people who went along to the show didn't just think, oh, that looked wonderful. They looked and thought, well, if he can do that, then I can probably do that. Now, how do I learn to do that? And that was a big change compared to anything else that we've seen in any other kinds of shows, in any other kind of performances. This connection, this, this personal investment in the show. You see it and don't just admire it. You see it and want to do it. And I think that was pivotal. And no one could have predicted the results and what happened afterwards. When I started researching the timelines for this podcast, I was trying to sort of fit them into my own personal timeline and see what I was doing at the various times when things happened. And I was 17 when the show Tango Argentino was first performed in France. And I must have been 24-ish when the show was performed in the UK. Now, thinking about that, I do vaguely remember hearing something about tango when I was in my early 20s, and I hadn't really sort of encountered it before, and so it sort of stuck. Now, I don't know if you remember from a previous episode of this podcast, I mentioned that my father was a champion ballroom dancer at some point in his dancing career, and so I would talk to him about dancing. And I do remember from that sort of period hearing something about this tango show and how it was very popular and very good, and wondering whether it was something I could get along to see, but for some reason it never happened. So I very nearly managed to get to see the original performance in London. Quite confused as to why I didn't, actually. I can't really remember the situation, but I remember wanting to go and see it, but I don't really remember it happen. Well, I know it didn't happen. I don't really remember why it didn't happen, which is strange. But yes, it's funny when you start to think about things as history, and then you realise that, you know, you were in your 20s when they happened. Now, I know that makes me very old. I'm not actually that old. I think it's more of a case of sometimes big historical events happen a lot more recently than we thought. It is strange to think that I so nearly saw that show, and I could have been there at the moment when it first arrived in the UK. And yet somehow it took me 20-something years after that to then actually discover tango and learn more about it and then begin to dance it. Yes, history is strange at times. I'll look at this in more detail later on in the book, but it's funny to think, isn't it, that pretty much all of the tango we see today can in some way trace its roots back to the show in Paris, or things that were spawned as a result of the show in Paris. The milongas in Europe and in North America all took their style from what was in the show. And so in a lot of ways, everything that we see now in tango and in the milongas and the way it's performed and in the demonstrations we see of tango take a lot of their influences from that show. So I think it is fair to say that a huge amount of tango really can trace its lineage back to that show rather than back to Buenos Aires directly, which is interesting, particularly when we start looking at Tango Nuevo, Neo Tango in the next episode, and how tango started to evolve and change even before we get to what I would call the modern Neo Tango era. So that's it for this podcast episode. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Next time, I'll be looking at Tango Nuevo and Neo Tango, what the terms mean and where they came from. Anyway, look after yourselves. Keep dancing. As I say, I will see you next week. This website and podcast are copyright 2017 to 2025 Graham Guy. All rights reserved. The Neo Tangology logo and the name Neo Tangology are trademarks of Graham Guy. All other trademarks mentioned on the website or in the podcast are the properties of their respective owners. No part of the content of the website or podcast may be reproduced in any form without written permission from the author. This podcast was recorded and produced at Hawthorne Studios in Biggin Hill.